In this week's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with health and wellness coach and published author Jeb Stewart-Johnston. Jeb and his company Food on the Mind specialize in coaching for emotional eating and binge eating. We also spoke about the role of stress and our systemic influence when it comes to eating patterns. I'm excited for you to listen to my conversation with Jeb, and please, if you enjoy this show, subscribe and give us a rating or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much. Now, without further ado, on to my conversation with Jeb. Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with health and wellness coach and published writer Jeb Stewart-Johnston. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's my absolute pleasure, and I'm excited to talk to you about all things emotional eating, binge eating, and everything else that pertains to nutrition coaching. You have a wonderful company called Food on the Mind, and I know that there are going to be lots of topics for us to talk about. But before we do so, I would love to hear a bit about you as a person, how you got into the space, and what you're doing today.
Well, I'll make an abbreviated version because it's a very long circuitous route that got me here. I was an opera singer and went to college for voice. I ended up transitioning into commercial songwriting and commercial singing in Nashville. In doing that, I became a bartender, ended up managing nightclubs for a little bit. I transitioned out of that career when I moved in with my wife because she was tired of me working at nights. So I became a hairdresser and worked as a celebrity hairdresser in New York City. Worked a lot with models, supermodels. So I was more on the fashion side of things. Had my work at one point was in probably every major publication. If you picked it up, either my cuts, color, styling, something was in there. Ad campaigns I had done, lost passion with that for a variety of reasons. Was training with a buddy of mine. I'd gotten into fitness at not until later in life. I'd always been sports oriented, but never the lifting or nutrition or anything like that until my 30s. And the training partner I had met was a guy by the name of Sean Heisen. We worked out together in New York. He was the editor at Muscle and Fitness and Men's Fitness. And he really kind of taught me everything about fitness, introduced me to a lot of the big names in the industry. I got really, very lucky with a lot of really great mentors and became a personal trainer, opened my own studio in New York, left hair, mainly worked with a lot of creatives, artists types, and then got into nutrition coaching and ended up going 100% online. And then over the past decade or so, I've kind of developed this model, less about nutrition coaching and more in working on the emotions that tend to drive people's struggles with nutrition, with health, with wellness, rather than working only on what I call the side effects, which are weight. And, those things are side effects really of, I think, people's larger mental, emotional, spiritual self, physical selves, rather than those causing these issues.
Well, wonderful. It sounds like you've had seven lives all in one.
Yes,
I love it when people have a little bit unconventional stories and have dabbled into varying different things. And I think everything usually contributes to making you a better coach because you have seen so many different aspects and so many different walks of life in terms of people. So I'm curious to see and hear how you bring your previous experience, even just in the sense of working with celebrities and so on, into what you're doing right now. But I think it's so important that we have people that specialize in exactly what you're addressing. So the emotional side of eating. And I think everybody listening can relate to the fact that we're not just eating for, we don't just fuel our bodies. We eat for various reasons and emotional things, even happy things. We might be surrounding, or especially at this time of year, the year when we're recording this, holiday eating, we're all joyous and letting loose and yay. If you like your family, you might have a nice family setting and just be like, oh, whatever, screw healthy eating today. I'm just here and taking in my grandma's food or so. So all these are also emotions. I think we often neglect that side and focus too much on stress eating and sadness eating and all these things. But tell me why you made that shift from quote unquote macro coaching to addressing those emotions.
Well, I worked with a lot of clients, so great success. Plenty of people lost 100 pounds, and more. What I found was that there are almost no long-term success stories in that world. Not because the dieting doesn't work, right? They can point to the actual results of what occurred from the diet. It's just more so that the diet itself never addresses the reasons a diet was needed in the first place. Sure, there are environmental reasons such as hyperpalatable foods, which makes the eating environment much more difficult. We are largely sedentary. But we have a particular issue in the United States. And in your Germany, you said you live in South America.
Yes.
Whereabouts are you?
I'm currently in Bolivia. I've spent a lot of
Okay.
time over the last few years in Colombia, but currently I'm in Bolivia.
So one of the big differences between the United States and Western Europe or even South America is that societally, environmentally, so many things are built in to the structural life, such as integrated movement. Cities are built to be walkable. You don't have mega superstores with 85 kinds of cereal. You go to get your bread one place. You go to get your meat one place. Your social environment is so much more important. It's not like here where people's social events revolve around what practice they're taking their kids to. It's like having a robust social network is so important in those places. And so we have this kind of isolation here, and that's what I saw in my clients was they didn't have a sense of community. They didn't have a sense of even autonomy in their choices. Everything was dictated by these external things. And how do we create this kind of internal locus of control when everything seems to be pulling you in different directions? And that's when I realized that this was an emotional issue. This was an internal issue. This was not a thing of like, oh, I don't know what to eat, because everyone knows what a healthy plate looks like for the most part. There's the outliers that don't, but most people do. And they still choose this other thing. Well, why is that? So to me, that's what's fascinating. And so my own personal interest and just not wanting, like, macro coaching's fine. It's boring to me. I'm not really interested in throwing numbers at people. They can get an app to do that. This is somewhat selfish. That doesn't interest me. What interests me is watching people do things that they know are antithetical to their goals and still doing them, and me being like, okay, that's wild. Why do people do that? Why do we all do it? And so, can we arrive at those, maybe not answers, but can we arrive to some different solutions for the problems they're facing? And can we address these in a deeper manner that allow you to live your life while also embracing a quote unquote healthier lifestyle?
I really like how you're putting that, and from what I'm hearing you say there as well, like with people being more isolated, and I think in general it's more of a kind of a buzzword almost, that there's like a mental health crisis with that as being more isolated. So of course there's I do see a very clear difference between, for example, even Germany is a very individualistic society. You know, we were like taught to pursue our own fulfillment through in terms of our careers and so on. Versus here, it is even more so family based and so on. But I think the US is another level up higher of isolation, personal isolation, perhaps at times, because you often have to move so far away for work purposes and so on. So I do hear a lot that many people in the US are struggling with mental health, with feeling lonely, with not being able to connect to people. So how do you go about addressing that with your clients, though? Because you might be uncovering that layer of like, okay, you're eating because you're lonely at night or so, but you can't just say like, well, go out and make 10 friends. It would be nice if that was the cure. But yeah.
Well, there's a difference between loneliness and being alone, right? And so we have this, I deal a lot with what I refer to kind of as my demon genius platform. And that is this idea that we all struggle with these demons, right? When you hear someone say like, oh, a part of me wants to do this, and another part of me wants to do that. Well, I actually just there's a methodology called internal family systems that talks about this. And so I actually just extrapolate that to like, okay, well, what that part of you, cool. Like, what is that part? Like, real simple. It doesn't have to be some deep-seated emotional drawing out. Like, what is that part? What's it trying to protect you from? And I'll call that your demons, right? And so everyone has their demons when they talk about self-sabotage or the critic or whatever. Well, interestingly enough, the Greek origin of demon actually means deity or genius. So within your demons are your genius. Part of why you're so good at these other things you do is because of these things that might be holding you back in another avenue. Can we make those quote unquote demons into allies that help us rather than harm us? And so it's really that simple self-awareness to start of saying like, oh, I'm doing this thing. It's like, okay, because I'm lonely. Oh, well, that's great. You can identify that. Well, you know, you've got this board of directors in your head that you can talk to. You've got this self that you can become acquainted with that will make you feel less lonely, even when you're alone. And then it could be as simple as picking up the phone and calling a friend, knowing that this is your vulnerability at that time, that you find yourself lonely at 8 p.m. on a Friday night. Hey, what can you do? It's going to require, you know, this is where we kind of vacillate between that systemic issues and the personal responsibility part is like, okay, you know that you're isolated physically, but you do have an ability to reach out to somebody. You're going to have to take that on. That's going to be hard. It's going to feel uncomfortable. You don't want to bother people or whatever, but find a way to do that for yourself. It's not selfish. It becomes selfless because it allows you to be more connected and to actually help others too.
Yeah, I think it's there's a really good point to this because it also insinuates that we have to put some effort into things or into creating and building and keeping those relationships ourselves.
Oh,
Because
yeah.
I think oftentimes people think like, oh, I don't have any friends or I don't know anybody here, and it sounds like friendships or relationships of any kind should be something that just happen naturally. And as someone who travels a lot, I have learned that I, number one, need to put myself out there. And this, like, people, it's really clear to people that, hey, you need to do that when it comes to dating, for example. Or, hey, you need to put in some effort if you want to have a good relationship with your family members. But when it comes to other relationships, like friendships that are not existent yet or so, I think it's a lot less obvious. And so I often go out and be like, okay, I'm not using my headphones when I'm going to the gym, at least not
Right.
every day. Or when I'm going to a cafe, I might plan a little bit of extra time, not just for working, but also at least have a little bit of a chit chat with the person sitting next to me or with the barista or like these kind of things. And then growing on them. And even if it's just paying someone a compliment once a day, like having those little goals for yourselves where you're like, I'm specifically making an effort to make a connection with someone, even without the expectation of this is going to become my best friend, but still just putting yourself out there. And I'm saying this because I too used to believe like friendships, either you have them or you don't, they happen or they don't. But just like with everything else, I have found that it requires effort, it requires time, and it requires continuous nurturing. Otherwise, they're not going to stay or come into existence.
Yeah, my word for 2024 was curiosity. And if I can approach everything with curiosity rather than judgment, I tend to do way better in social situations. I'm not a naturally like social person. I'm from New York. Like I moved down here to South Carolina. It's a very different culture. It's like you just talk to people. And honestly, it's been the best thing for me because it forced me out of my comfort zone of just like isolating. But there's a lot of other avenues you can take. One of the things that for me is so big is I do jiu-jitsu every morning. I go to a 6 a.m. jiu-jitsu class and like, yes, we train and we're beating each other up and all that. But a big part of it is this like fellowship. If it's a social, we all have a group chat that we procrastinate all of our work during, you know, during work days and chat on there. But to your point, it does require nurturing and it requires reaching out and it requires being uncomfortable, especially for a lot of us who that's just not my fallback position. It's like I'm fine in my office with a book. Like I'm okay with that. But it is good for the soul and it's important for us to feel connected.
Yeah, absolutely. I am more introverted by nature as well, so I've definitely found that it just requires some effort. And I've also learned that it's fine to do it on my terms. It doesn't mean I need to go out at 10 o'clock at night and sit in a bar, which both of these things I hate. So I
Right.
you know, it can be in my terms and trying to meet people in a in a coffee shop or library or wherever I go. But yeah, I'm curious that once you have kind of like uncovered some of those layers of like why someone is eating, what are some practical strategies that you give your clients in terms of overcoming that urge to engage in that when it's so clearly against their actual goals?
So I have a kind of scale that I try to grade people on in our initial conversations. I give them a little strength finder test to start, and then we have a little exercise that they use to build their kind of what I call their action plan, and that's their values. And then we create some goals, which are some behaviors that fall under that, and some actions, some actual specific things they can take to get there. So what I find through that is I can kind of determine whether or not this person is what I would call more an intuitive person or more of a logical person, right? So anyone who leans heavily into that intuition, you can judge that by like someone who's like kind of that hyper empath, right? Like something happens across the world that's bad and they're in bed for 2 days because they're so crushed by it. That person, like leaning into this emotional stuff, is not going to be like, we want to be aware of it, but we don't want to heavily use that because that's going to draw them into a cycle. So I generally lean towards more of these skill-based approaches. So something like real simple of like, can we create an intentional action plan where it's like, okay, I'm scared of these things happening. Okay, well, if this happens, what then? Right? Or maybe a pros and cons list, like very simplistic, almost like seemingly childish tools that are very specifically logically based and takes some of their emotional leanings out of the picture. On the other hand, I have people that are heavily involved in emotional eating that don't actually recognize they have any emotions. Think your engineers. I actually work with quite a few psychologists and psychiatrists in my practice, and for them, they understand the intuitive, but some of them are very, heavily kind of almost dissociating from emotions because of the work they do. And of course, they're going to be the people who are most open to this stuff because they're actively working on themselves generally. But maybe like an engineer or a computer scientist or a pharmacist who's just like, they're all about numbers. Well, we need to say, like, I know you don't think this is emotional eating, but I want you to try to identify some emotions that might be going on. And then they're like, oh. One of the great quotes I heard once, and I forget who said it, was that we tend to think of ourselves as logical beings sometimes prone to emotion. And in reality, we're emotional beings sometimes prone to fits of logic, right? Our logic is very few. And the people who think that they're most, the facts over feelings crowd, the people that are like, I'm so logical, you can just watch them get wrapped up in emotion every time they make a comment on social media or whatever it is. So it tends to be the people that are those people we need to be like, okay, let's start to get into this squishy stuff because that's going to make you super uncomfortable, but that's where the work needs to be done. So I think in terms of practicality, if you're dealing with someone who's super logical, just getting them to identify some emotions, right? And give them an emotion wheel. Let them like pick out and get granular with it. That's something that Lisa Feldman Barrett, a brilliant psychologist and neuroscientist, talks about, is granularity. Really identify that. And then can we start to see where that trips us up? On the other hand, those other people, right? What is some really just simple skills-based stuff? Like I said, like a pros and cons list, or if someone's engaged in an emotional eating episode, what can we do in that moment? That could be like doing some burpees, putting a cold ice pack on the back of your neck, something to break the behavior at that moment. So then we can start to do some of the work with it. And that might be sitting and doing a breathing exercise or a somatic exercise where we try to feel where that is in our body. What the anxiety is it? What is that? So just kind of knowing that vacillating between these two sides of like more intuitive approaches and more skills-based approaches, and where is that appropriate? And that just takes some time. But I think if you have a good relationship with your clients and trust, you can try things out because not everything's going to work, and just see what works for them and keep trying things. And what works this week might not work next week. That's the other thing. And so like having a large toolbox is very helpful.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point. And everyone listening, and even myself, as you walked through some of those traits of the two kind of categories, I think we also sometimes might be shifting in and out of one. Even though I probably would classify myself as more like the second bucket of like, oh, I'm just a logical person, blah, blah, blah. I no doubt I sometimes fall into that first category. So as you said, having more tools to use whenever appropriate is probably a really good way to go about it.
Yeah, it's just a spectrum, right? Like, and we can move along it, and that's that kind of biopsychosocial model. Is some of it's biological, some of it's psychological, and some of it's social conditioning. Any of those things changes in your environment, obviously your biology is not going to change, but those other two pieces are highly malleable. So you can be in Bolivia right now, and then you could be in Argentina in a month, and that might change how you respond to stimuli.
Yeah, definitely. And one thing I wanted to pick up on that you mentioned earlier, and that was the verbiage that you use, or the getting people to get very specific on what kind of emotion they're feeling. Because I truly think that the English language in particular, but actually probably most languages in this world, are super limited when it comes to granular or being very specific about how we feel. We just say like, oh, I'm stressed. Like everything is kind of under that.
Everything's stressed, right? Every single client.
What do you mean? Is that positive? It could be positive.
Yeah.
Like, are you excited about everything that's coming up for you? It is a lot though. You're feeling maybe under pressure, but it's exciting stuff. Or are you literally feeling overwhelmed and it's just too much? Are you feeling anxiety because of something from the past? Are you feeling like there's just so many nuances to that. So I like what you said about getting more specific on it and not just saying like, oh, I'm stressed for everything, or oh, I'm sad about, well, like, what are you, how, what kind of sadness is this? This is like, happy sadness. You're sad to see this go, this person go, or
Yeah.
like there's just so much to that. So I think, journaling or even just talking to someone about it is so helpful when it comes to like, okay, why am I actually feeling that? Why am I feeling anxious? Like, what kind of anxiety is that that I'm actually perceiving? Because you might find that it's actually something positive or something that has to do with your past. And so the more we can kind of like uncover that, I think that that's really helpful.
Yeah, as a big fan of my hobbies include reading philosophy. Like I know my hobbies besides jujitsu is like music, jujitsu, and like I love to read philosophy. I love to read about language, and you know that's one of the things about language in general is that it is always incapable of actually describing the human experience. We're just finding the closest label we can find to what that is. And so, like you said, talking about it, journaling, I mean, all journaling is just writing stuff down. I mean, 90% of the time when we have a problem we're running through in our heads, writing it down, it's so dumb, but just writing it down changes the perspective and be like, okay, what am I actually afraid of? Okay, that's silly. Like, I already have eight solutions for that lined up that I know I could do. Like, I don't need to be afraid of that.
Yeah, it really puts some distance. It makes you like an observer of what you're feeling.
Yes,
Like you're
that's a
telling
great way
it
to
to
put it.
someone else and you're just suddenly like, oh, with this bird's eye view, I'm trying to explain it to, well, myself in this case. But yeah, I think that that's really the beauty of where that comes in. And you mentioned something else, which was like the influence of our surroundings, or like the systemic influence on our behaviors and so on. And I would like to get into that because I think often people use that too much as a shield, or on the other end of the spectrum, they're not aware of how negatively their environment really affects them. So maybe you can explain, first of all, what systemic influence really is, or how you deal with that with your clients.
Yeah, I think that really nobody actually uses it too much of a shield. I think most people are ha just don't have an awareness of how much it influences them. We look at, you know, I mean, I know in the Western world it's super popular to be like, oh, you're in control of your destiny, and like, you probably don't have nearly as much control over that as you think you do. And particularly, again, I like to read about neuroscience, and we think about. When we make a choice or a decision, we think that that's this like in the moment thing, but all we are is really computing machines, right? Emotions are really just indicators of where our intuition feels like it should take us based on prior experience. And that prior experience is all based on systemic influence. Again, if you were raised in the United States versus being raised in, say, Thailand, your entire outlook on the world is going to be vastly different. We look kind of at the, you know, societal influence, let's say, in the United States. Again, the thing I'll come down to is like, we as a society believe that like choice, freedom, all of these things are the ultimate terms of freedom. But I would argue that having 85 kinds of cereal in the aisle is not necessarily freedom. It's just allowing you to get blinded by choice and kind of fall into, buying more stuff, right? Consumerism, whatever that looks like. So we naturally have an inclination here to try to buy our way or bootstrap our way out of all of our problems, which unfortunately is the only solution we have here because we're not set up. I spend a lot of time in Europe and like I go to Amsterdam. Anyone that I see that's like overweight or even borderline obese is usually from another country, right? Because there's what, 500,000 people there, what, 1 million people there, and there's like, or there's 500,000 people and there's like 1 million bikes or whatever. Like the fact there's twice as many bikes as people, everyone walks everywhere. The food isn't like low-cal, right? Like and people drink beer, people smoke cigarettes, and they all live longer. But the stress is way lower, even though Amsterdam, I would say, Netherlands are definitely more not quite to the US, but more say than most continental Europe, right? If you go to France or you go to Austria, it's going to be a little bit more societal, right? And then you go to the UK. UK is a lot like the United States, and in Australia, I think it's a lot like the United States. And you start to see obesity kind of ramp up a little bit in those places. And I think a lot of that has to do with the underlying stress, right? When people say they're always stressed. You go to South America, people who have so much less, that have less choice, maybe they don't have, but they seem to be a lot more content. Now, obviously there's going to be other struggles there, like, in terms of healthcare or access to certain things or even access to healthy foods, like in some places, which we find here in the United States, we find food deserts. So I think understanding that you are so influenced by our environment that you don't even know it. That allows you to then be like, okay, what are the interventions I can take to try to subvert that environment? And so a big one for myself and a lot of my cohort of coaches that I work with is that we're huge into like something as simple as buying a walking pad because you know that you're working from your desk all day. Can you get on that thing and get some steps in, right? And not even about weight loss or anything like that, but it takes between 6,000 and 8,000 steps just to induce the hunger signaling that you need for a normal day. Most Americans are getting like 3,000 to 4,000 steps a day. Like they can't even use hunger signaling as a way to eat because it's not regulated at all. We're meant to move. It's like it's such a something as simple as that is an intervention that can kind of help you get around the environmental impact. Hyperpalatable foods are a real thing. If you move more, you have more ability to utilize calories. That's going to help prevent some of these issues. And then just learning, I think that's where the macros thing was super helpful, is it helped people to be like, oh, like protein, fats, and carbs, that's what these are. It's like, yeah, okay. Now what are you going to do with it? So now, like, what to eat, how to eat. That doesn't mean you don't ever have a peanut butter cup or a slice of pie or whatever, but it means that you understand that it's going to be highly caloric. It's not going to fill you up and it's not going to do what you want it to do for most of the time. So can you create a majority of your life looking like, similar stuff, right? Like looking at like healthy meals and then have those things as the occasional treat, the joy, rather than the go-to, because you see a lot of people that like, oh, I stop for Starbucks for breakfast, and then at lunch I go to McDonald's, and then for dinner I stop and grab whatever. And you're like, yeah, it's probably not going to work. Plus, it's just really expensive.
So many great points. And I mean, I have worked and I'm still working with people all over the world, and including a lot of people in the Middle East, for example, as
Oh,
well
yeah.
in Asia.
Very big difference.
Very big differences. And I mean, initially as a coach, I made some mistakes. For example, if someone would be like, I'm going to my mom's on Sunday for food, we always share the food. And you're like, oh, can you just try to make your own plate? That was such a dumb suggestion on my side because I didn't know any better that them just putting all the food in the middle and you have a little bit from here, a little bit of there, and it's literally like you can't, it is very difficult to like classify the quantity. So like educating myself and also the clients on how do we go about that? Because clearly that one big family get together on a Sunday looks very different there than it would do in Germany or in the US for that matter, or on other occasions, saying to a client in the Philippines or Thailand or whatever, let's just not eat the rice for a little while. Can you just like substitute that with, the German in me coming out, just substitute that with potatoes because it's more safe eating. They're like, A, I don't like potatoes. B, we don't really have a lot of potatoes here. And C, I need my rice. That's like, so
It's
like,
a cultural.
yeah, we even as coaches, we learn how to approach things differently.
Well, I think too, and what I stress is I always say, like, what I do, I never call what I do my business. I call it my practice. And I tell clients, all we're doing is practice. And so if you look at it like that, that's not a failure. Now, if you had done that and then kept saying, no, you just have to figure out how to make your own plate, like, that would be a failure. But you were practicing. You were like, oh shit, that was a blind spot I had that I didn't know how can I remedy that? How can I fix that? Okay, cool. You're working on the same things that we work on with our clients, and understanding that's just good coaching.
Well, thank you. And I mean, yeah, continuously trying to grow. And I think, of course, while each country has some advantages and disadvantages, so for example, I also, when I went back to the US last year for the first time in a few years, and I entered, I think, I don't even remember what hyper mega whatever store it was. I literally just went in there for a protein bar. And I could not believe the quantity of protein bars, and I was overwhelmed. And I mean, that's a quote unquote healthy food. And I, in the end, I just went. I did what most people do. I just went with the one or two brands that I had heard of slash where I knew the logo. So I grabbed what I had grabbed before instead of looking at all the 38 different kinds. And so I think that that's how a lot of people feel. They go in there stressed again or short on time, and then they're like, oh, I don't know what to grab, I'll just grab what I always grab, and that's how they're stuck in that cycle. But yeah, the other side of the, I guess, systemic influence that I was kind of referring to a little bit also, when it comes to the shield, is that more on that individual level, I think, where we sometimes say, oh, everyone in my family is big boned, or everyone in my family has a hard time losing weight, perhaps. And I think that that is, I mean, I don't know if your clients say that too sometimes, but I think we have that macro level of like, okay, what country are we in? What's the culture there? How much do we walk? And then we have the what are the 5/10 people immediately around you doing in terms of food? How were you brought up in terms of food? Because I'm sure that you see
Oh
that
yeah.
influences your clients as well.
Yeah, and there is a case to be made that, like, yeah, if your whole family has trouble losing weight, there probably is a genetic concept there. Now, what, that's that the saying that I love is genetics loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger. So if that same family had been raised, in a completely different society, would they struggle with weight? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Now, what happens though is because that genetics that kind of passed down as some people might be a little bit hungrier than others. And maybe you're more stressed. Maybe you don't know how to manage. So with my work is what we do is we try to manage the things. Like, it's like kind of like it drives me crazy because most of the internet, social media especially, is just like hyperbole and like saying things that don't really mean anything. And so, like, when coaches who are primarily macro coaches get mad about the hormone coaches. They're like, hormones don't make you gain weight. It's like, well, no, but the hormones influence all the things that make you gain weight. So, if you have a hor like if there's something hormonal that's going on, it might make you hungrier. It might make you less satiated. It might make you want to move less. Medications change people's non-exercise activity thermogenesis on its own, right? And so that can make you less able to manage calories. So it's not that the laws of thermodynamics now don't no longer apply, but it is that this idea that there's a reason that all of your family struggles, and it's probably not just the genetics, it's probably all of the other things that influence them. And so can you change your past? No. But that also doesn't mean that you can't change the present and the future, right? Like that the past is the past. It's fine. Like you accept it. You are where you are. It's not your fault. But now, if you want to change things, it does become your responsibility to start to take on the hard things. And is that fair? No, but it's reality. We have to accept, if we want to move forward, we have to accept where we are.
Yeah, I love that you threw personal responsibility in out there, because I think that that's really the first place to start. And I mean, most of the time when people come to us as coaches, they are taking somewhat ownership of where they're at right now. I have had clients where they're like, you get the perception that they just think they're paying you, and so now they should see results regardless of the effort that
Sure.
they're putting in. But I think once we
But I
can.
think it's really important to say that it's not their fault where they're
Yes,
at. Because I think that's the thing, is like the personal responsibility thing gets so wrapped up in this, like everything is personal. It's like that doesn't work. It hasn't, we've been trying personal responsibility as the cure-all in the United States since 1980, and all we've seen is people get poorer and get less healthy. Because we haven't taken the structural changes that actually will probably, but unfortunately, I can't change policy. I can't change the way that a city is mapped out. I can't. So all I can do is help people to work with dealing with those things that are in place and how can they manage them better. I would love to be able to be like, yep, we're going to make all cities have green spaces and everyone's going to move around. They're going to walk everywhere, but.
I've shared this story before. So again, a year ago, I went back to the States, and I was at the gym, and I wanted to get to the Starbucks, which was literally across the road. I could see it, but I could not walk there. It would have taken me 15 minutes, because I had to cross a highway, and there was no walking way. So I would have had to walk for like 15 minutes to get there, and it was like a half a minute drive. I was just like, how is this possible? I
But
can
we
really
drive
feel
everywhere.
it. Yeah.
Like, and I'm guilty of it. Like I moved to South Carolina and it's like in New York, if something was a mile and a half away, you didn't think about walking. I mean, you're just walking. Like, first of all, it's more of a pain to try to get in subway. Whatever. Here, it's like a mile and a half away, and you're like, yeah, we'll just drive down there and park and come. Like, that's just what
Of
you do.
course. Yeah, no, I mean, that's what I ended up doing as well. I drove there because
Yeah.
I couldn't walk. It was not safe enough. That's even,
Right.
it was
Yeah.
not safe enough to walk there. But yeah, I mean, I like what you say, just simply giving people or working with the situations that people are have right now. So if someone's listening to that and they're like, well, I totally fall into the category of, well, emotional eating from time to time, feeling stressed from time to time, having an unfortunate layout when it comes to activity and so on. What can I actually do? What are some things that you work on with your clients in terms of stress management and so on?
I mean, stress management, we really want to identify the stressor. It's like anything else, right? Like you made a great point. It's everyone is like, oh, how are you feeling? And it's like people either say stressed or, you know, men tend to like the only emotion they understand is anger, right? And so it's like, okay, well, like I'm stressed. Well, what are you stressed about? And again, like I'll take a client I talked a couple weeks ago. She knew she was headed to a trip. And she's one, she likes to have her food. Like it's like she doesn't, you know, it's she likes that stressor. So she had a at a got a refrigerator for the room, all that stuff. And I was like, okay, so what are your fears about the week? Well, what if the refrigerator doesn't work? Okay, what if it doesn't work? What would you do? Well, I could fill up the sink with ice, or you know, go get a disposable cooler. Okay, done. What's the other concern? You know, and so we just kind of went through like the concerns and was like, okay, well, now that we know we don't actually have to be anxious about those things, does that relieve some of the anxiety? It's like, oh yeah, cool. Like, so you know, anxiety, and again, I always come back to this kind of Buddhist philosophy of like depression is living in the past, anxiety is living in the future. It's a little reductive, but it really does. It's like if you're not being present, you're going to feel these things. So how can we work more on being present? And that might mean a meditation practice. It might mean journaling, a gratitude practice, breathing exercises, things like that. Breath work has become something that I'm, you know, kind of doing a lot more of, mainly because I developed asthma over the last couple of years, and the reason, and also, so this will actually tie in, is why do I do that now? It's like, 'cause I know it'll make my jiu-jitsu better because I'll be able to breathe better. So if we can tie these things into p things that people value that they think are important, it becomes much easier. I think a lot of times coaches struggle because they tie in things that they think are important for them and try to make it important for the client. And it's like, bottom line is like, especially the population. Now, my population all loves to work out. They all exercise. They're all into it. But they're also then mostly sedentary the rest of the day. And then they're also, they like food and, they have social events. They have kids. So there's all kinds of snacks in the house. So how can we start to tie these things into something that's important to them, which is usually very different than people who've decided to make a living out of talking to people about food and exercise and health? Like, that's clearly what we're good at. And like we think that everyone's like us. It's like, no, we're really good at this one thing. And I know that fitness people all think they're really good at everything else, but most of them are terrible in almost every other life domain. Like, and these are all my friends. I'm friends with these people because they're all like somewhat psychotic. That's why I like the people in the industry that I do. But most people aren't like that. They have so many other things to worry about. And so, like, how can we make it important? And I think that that's when you start to realize that reducing your stress around that systemic stress, right? That stress that just sits there. Like, you stress, like small stress is great. Like exercise, that kind of stress, like the things that really get you going, those are awesome. But if we allow that other stuff to kind of manage our lives, we don't live in the present. And so how can we make that important to them?
Yeah, I think that's awesome because it really makes the life worth living, right? I mean, in the end,
That I love that phrase right there. Have a life worth living. I love that.
it's the present moments that add up to be our lives. And so otherwise, before we know it, we're like, oh, 10 years down the road, where did that time go? I don't even know. So and I'm huge on breath work as well. And I think when people hear breath work, at least that's where my mind initially went, always was like, Wim Hof, I need to do like a
Right.
20-minute hard out session. And I think I always like to give people like it can be as simple as you're just pausing for a second, taking two three deep breaths.
Yeah.
That's it. Like even just that awareness of like, oh, okay, I'm feeling stressed right now. What can I do to bring my heart rate down a little bit? Exhaling more deeply for a few breaths right here at my desk in the middle of an office. Nobody's gonna see it. Sweet. That is a form of breath work as well. It doesn't have to be that 20, 30 hard out breath work session in the morning paired with your cold plunge, paired with your workout, paired with 20 minutes of sunlight viewing. It does not have to be that.
Yeah, because all it is, it's like a meditation, right? You're just bringing awareness to the moment. You're paying attention to something very specific, allowing your thoughts to kind of pass through. But it brings a focus. And from a central nervous system response, it actually does a lot for kind of getting you like out of that sympathetic into the parasympathetic. But like even beyond that, it's just bringing yourself into the present moment. That's it. And all the other benefits are huge. That's why I'm doing more of it, is because the other benefits. But at the end of the day, that presence is just, that's the simple thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always think like experimenting with these things and just finding what works for that person, just to your point, is exactly it. Whether it's like something like box breathing or whether it's literally just more deep exhales or so, like
And
meeting.
there's no negative, there's no
Yeah.
cost. Right?
Yes.
Like it, okay. So yeah, maybe you lost 5 minutes of your day. Okay. But did anything bad come out of paying attention to your breathing? No. No. It's
Exactly.
so something, even if nothing good happens, at least nothing bad happens. So you can try it out. And I find that there's probably no one on earth that would not find some benefit from it. It just has to be consistent, and you have to, like
That
everything else,
is.
you gotta work, you gotta do a little work. And unfortunately, at the end of the day, like I would love to come up with, if I had a way that wasn't like, a lot of people will come to me in my coaching and they're like, I'm so tired of macros, like all this stuff feels like work. And I was like, I got bad news for you. This stuff is gonna feel like a lot more work. This stuff is actually super hard and uncomfortable. If I knew a way that you didn't need to, I tell everyone I'd be flying on my private jet to your podcast instead of talking on Zoom.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I wanted to highlight that one word that you threw out there, and that's like my favorite all-time word, and that's just doing things consistently. I think particularly when it comes to things like meditation, journaling, and breath work, we think like, oh, I did it 3 times in a row and nothing happened. Like I don't feel any better, I don't feel any different from it. So it clearly doesn't work. But I know that that's not how these things work. It's just like if you go to the gym 3 times and you feel like, okay, you might feel a little bit sore after that, but you're still not going to have like huge biceps or whatever. And you just say, oh, it doesn't work because I still don't have a bicep, have a bigger bicep. So it's like it's that consistency, even if it's 2 minutes a day.
Yeah, and I think that comes down to like the outcome process kind of thing, right? Like outcomes are important. We want to reach them, but all they are is mile markers. Because the interesting thing about goals is, especially people who are very goal oriented, is achieving goals doesn't actually feel that good. Like it feels good for a short moment, but then you're like, ugh, like now I feel bad because I'm done with the thing that I've worked so hard for. Whereas if you look at it as a mile marker and like, what I'm getting out of this practice can't just be the outcome at the end. Like I have to be getting something out of it. And so I've been big on a kick of like rituals over rules and like thinking about your daily rituals and what are my daily rituals? Well, my daily rituals are to get some type of movement in the morning, right? It's not, I have to work out for 60 minutes at the gym, da-da, because that becomes setting myself up for failure. Whereas if I say, the ritual is that I want to get movement in every day. I'm setting myself up for success because it doesn't have to look a certain way. And that's same thing with like journaling. It doesn't have to be like, oh, I have to journal every day for 30 minutes. It can be like my rule is to journal every day. That could be one word. Doesn't have to be anything profound. And so I think like to your point, how do we the way that we build consistency is to find value in the thing we're doing versus the outcome we're pursuing.
Yeah, wonderful. I mean, Jeff, you've given us so many wonderful things to well think about, but also even put into a practical action. And I'm gonna make sure to put a link to your mini course, a 5 day course of freedom from food obsession, into the show notes,
Yes.
because I do want people to go and check it out. And if you listening feel like you have been spoken to in the sense of emotional eating or anything like that, you're gonna benefit from this course. I have absolutely no doubt. So thank you so much for your time. Honestly, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah, it was great to meet you. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. And yes, I will also, of course, link your Instagram and any other kind of handle. So truly, thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jeb. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. And one more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening, and don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.